All right. Church history. If this seems like it's dragging to any of you at all, we have I've shaved off at this point about 15 lessons that I've taught this for TBDI. So I have been shaving quite a bit off. There's some stuff up here on the board that I don't want to spend that much time on. Any one of those singular things. Intend to be quite brief with some of it, just because some of it is just not very interesting. So if I get too deep into it, it's going to get boring. But some of these things are things that you know a little bit about, you've heard about here and there, and you probably don't know a lot about some of this. We're going to start with the Crusades. Most of you know a little bit about, the Knights Templar, and you've seen stuff in movies and stuff, but just have to get this out to use it. Crusades ran from 1096 to 1248, and by the Crusades, what we mean is it usually refers to the seven organized Roman Catholic Crusades to recover the Holy Land from the Seljuk Turks. And add to that one more, the so-called Children's Crusade. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, so we're not going to get bogged down in it. But think about the fact that here you have a bunch of paganized, quote-unquote, Christians. They're not Christians. They're Roman Catholics. And they are paganized in that they are completely sold on relics, the Holy Land, etc., etc., and the holy places, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and this, that, and the other. And so when the Muslims came in and captured Jerusalem, then moved on up and started capturing much of Turkey, well, a bunch of these folks are really, really upset. And so they send, as pilgrims, a lot of those folks, the Catholics, wanted to go back to the Holy Land as pilgrims, and come in contact with holy places and holy relics and the bones of John the Baptist and Mary's milk and all that kind of stuff. Because, after all, if you do touch that stuff, you are really spiritually blessed. And so it really upsets them that the Turks and the Muslims have taken control of the land. If you, for instance, are in France or Italy or in Germany, if you don't go by sea, your best bet is to march, over to the Bosporus Strait there in Istanbul, Constantinople then, and cross over and go on down into Turkey. And that way you have access down to the Holy Land and the other places that were captured in Turkey. And so what's going on is that folks are trying to go and do that. And meanwhile, the Muslims are trying to stop them. They're suffering reproach, they're being robbed and everything on their journeys. After all, they are bringing money and all that kind of stuff. And so the Catholic Church is all upset, and so they try to round up these Crusades so that they get a mass of people that go and march on Turkey, effectively, or down into the Holy Land to try to recover these holy sites. And of course, it didn't work out very well. There are technically seven Crusades. And usually then there's another one they call the Children's Crusade, which you'll find in a minute. It's very sad. By the way, in 1492, Columbus not only sailed the ocean blue, but he promised that he would devote any profits from his voyage to the recovery of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. So it was a major, major thing in that day. So here's how this worked. You formed a crusade by getting a pope or a monk or a hermit, or a priest, up, and they would get the people whooped up to a march on, again, a march on Turkey, march on the Holy Land, cross the Bosporus Strait, go through all that walking, and go down there and thrash these awful heretics that have stolen the Holy Land. And of course, what they're not realizing is that the Lord used the Muslims to whoop up on a godless Christianity. By that, I mean no Christianity at all, just a bunch of relic-worshipping, cannibalistic pagans. And so, get this straight, here you have a bunch of Catholic pagans marching on Turkey and the Holy Land to try to recover ground that another pagan nation that God's used to judge their Christianity, again, Christianity with quotation marks. These pagans are marching on those pagans, and God has used those pagans to whoop up on you, and now you're trying to go in and get your stuff back. So that's what's going on. So the popes, the monks, the hermits all get the people whipped up by preaching to them and, revving up this fervor to go on a crusade. There had to be money enough, equipment enough, weapons enough, and all that. And there's many false starts because a few hundred or a few thousand people start up. But meanwhile, there's diseases that go through the camp. And along the way, they run into robbers. And also, of course, when the Turks realize that somebody's coming, they're going to put up a defense. And so an awful lot of people died at all this. The folks that went on the Crusades were many times kings, sometimes noble women. Often, most usually monks and soldiers and anybody that was desirous to go and on this adventure. Now, the Pope stayed home, as you might imagine. As far why you would go, for one, they were promised indulgences for their sins. So here you're a Catholic and you face a few hundred years in purgatory. But the Pope says he'll forgive you and you'll go straight to heaven if you go on this crusade. So that's one thing. If you're promised martyrdom and sainthood if you get killed on a crusade, you get oftentimes eternal life. They would cut a deal, write a contract, and if you went on a crusade, not only if you died would you go to heaven, but your parents could too, or your kids could too. Write out a contract, and, the Pope has the power to do that, So that's the idea. Absolution from sins. You don't have to do penance anymore. Don't have to go through all the Hail Marys and full of grapes and all that kind of stuff because you've been forgiven if you go on a crusade. Again, the European religious pilgrims were trying to get down there to worship and to go to their holy places, and it just didn't, these pagan Muslims, these wicked, wretched, ungodly Muslims were stopping them or making fun of them or robbing them or some stuff like that, and so it's just really bad. So that's the reason they're going. Now, you should know, just real quick, couple things here. One of the things that drew them to the land, again, you're dealing with Roman Catholicism. You're dealing with you're dealing with unregenerate pagans when you're talking about Roman Catholicism. And so from an early day, Jerusalem was the goal of Christian pilgrimages. The mother of Constantine, for instance, Helena, according to the legend, found the very cross that Christ was crucified on and built the church over the supposed site of the tomb in which the Lord lay. Besides all that, Jerome spent the last years of his life writing from Bethlehem. And so it's a major deal for them to go to the Holy Land. The Holy Land became to the imagination a land of wonders filled with the divine presence of Christ. To have visited it, to have seen Jerusalem, to have bathed in the Jordan, was for a man to have about him a halo of sanctity. The accounts of returning pilgrims were listened to in convent and on the street with open-mouthed curiosity. To surmount the dangers of such a journey in a pious frame of mind was a means of expiation from sins. So special laws were enacted in the pilgrims' behalf. Hospitals and other beneficent institutions were erected for their comfort along the main route and in Jerusalem. And so when the Muslims quit letting them do that, it was a major, major deal. And so what they started trying to do was they whipped up these crusades where they're going to take a volunteer army Sometimes kings would get involved. Sometimes princes would get involved. And of course, a few monks and stuff. And then the people would gather around. So I'll give you an idea. Again, seven proper crusades. The first crusade went from 1096 to about 1099. It covered about 3 years. There were four groups that wound up going. One group went because a guy named Walter the Penniless, now that's a monk, preached to him. And so 20,000 of them started on the journey. There was a second group that was 40,000 that started on the journey. So you have them going in columns, basically. Group number three, there were 15,000 that went there. And by the time it's all said and done, they have well over 200,000 people traipsing across Germany, France, and Italy, trying to get to the Bosporus Strait, and all going to cross over and go recapture the critical, holy places. And so by the time it's all said and done, there are 300,000 lives lost in this one campaign. They went and they captured, they besieged and captured Nicaea, Antioch, a place called Edessa, which is in Turkey, and also Jerusalem. Took them a long time. Again, this took 3 whole years, but they succeeded in taking Jerusalem, so they established the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem. Again, this was only for a brief time before Saladin came back in and took it back over a Muslim. But bottom line is they got those cities back for a short time. Among the people, important people that went was a guy named Godfrey of Bouillon, who was a French king. And when he got to Jerusalem and they succeeded in taking over Jerusalem, he promptly had himself elected king of Jerusalem. And so that's kind of what he was after. But it was just a few years later that Saladin came back in and all that was wiped out, and it cost 300,000 lives just running that first campaign, that first crusade. Second crusade came along about 1147 or so. Again, they're going back to a place in Turkey called Edessa because a Turk named Zengi had gone in there and captured the city. So the Pope calls on the French kings to go try to dig him out and get him out of there. And he promised eternal life to anybody that would go on this campaign. So Conrad, the king of Germany, got an army of 70,000 people to go with him and try to recapture. He was reduced by 10%. So 70,000, 10% of 70,000 they lost just on the way, on the march, because of the famine, the plague, and the disease, and so on. Also on that same campaign was Louis, the French king, who, by the way, took his wife Eleanor with him, but she cheated on him in the way, so he divorced her on the spot, and the Pope was all for that. Anyway, the two kings quarreled the whole time, and they didn't get anything done on this campaign. On the third crusade, this goes up 30 more years, 40 more years to 1189. The goal was to retake Jerusalem from Saladin. Now, this is the most romanticized crusade of the in literature. The characters were Frederick of Barbarossa, or Redbeard, from Germany, Philip Augustus from France, and a guy named Richard the Lionhearted from England. And along the way, Frederick died because he drowned. Philip Augustus from France, went home because all the spotlight was on Richard, the Lionhearted, and he didn't like not being in the spotlight, so he went home. And Richard the Lionhearted took Acre, which is near Mount Carmel, and murdered 2,700 prisoners in cold blood. Richard the Lionhearted is actually one of the more interesting guys in this whole thing, because whatever else is the case with him, he was a mighty warrior. He is known, was seen to have, with his sword, cleaved a guy in two. I mean, he both horsemen, both on horses. He took his sword and he cut a guy from here down to his waist, from here down to the saddle. Cut him in two. Like that. So pretty awesome dude. Kind of like that. I don't know if we'll get to replay that one, but whatever. Richard's feats of physical strength and martial skill were vouched for by eyewitnesses who speak of him as cutting swaths through the enemy with his sword and mowing them down as the reapers mow down the corn with their sickles. So mighty was his strength that on another occasion, when a Turkish admiral rode at him in full charge, Richard severed his neck and one shoulder with a single blow. So from here to here. just cut him in pieces. So, awesome. In the end, though, he was a big fat baby because after they won the battle, and he's going to go back home, he had made an enemy of the king of Austria. So when he came through Austria, the king of Austria arrested him and wouldn't let him go until he paid a bunch of money. So it's kind of a mixed bag of tricks for him, I guess. Anyway, well, that was the third crusade. The fourth crusade, this is up at the 1200 mark. Okay, remember Pope Innocent III, who wasn't the least bit innocent? Remember him? Okay, Innocent III wanted to capture Egypt as a base of operations by the Crusaders against Jerusalem. So the Crusaders assembled at Venice, Italy, but they got their big army down there that far, but they were short on money. They were going to sail to Egypt, of course, and they were short on money. And so the city of Venice agreed to exchange passage by ship if the Crusaders, the army, would go capture a city called Zara, and Zara is up in what we now know as Croatia. And so for some reason they had interest up there, and so since they had an army there, we'll give you a ride as long as you'll go fight and get our city back first. So 480 vessels carrying the Crusaders departed from Venice and landed on the shore near Zara and captured, plundered, and razed that city. So now the Pope is sitting there saying, what happened to my army? So he's mad at them, and so he excommunicates them. Well, the king of Constantinople, the emperor of Constantinople, heard that there was this hired gun, an army of crusaders running around Europe that were fighting battles for people. And so he sent to him and said, hired him to come and clear out his enemies in Constantinople. And now these guys are under excommunication by the Pope, right? And they say, why not? And so they get back on their ship and they head for Constantinople to help the king of Constantinople. What was plan A again? They were going to go from Venice to Egypt. Then they went and fought another secondary battle. And then they went ahead and fought another battle. And of course, they captured Constantinople and whipped up on the emperor of Constantinople's enemies. On the king of Constantinople, after it was all said and done, said, I don't have the money to pay you. And so the crusaders, now these are Christian crusaders. The Christian crusaders totally razed the city. I mean, the stories you read, the rapine, the murder, just breaking into everything and hauling stuff out into the street, whatever else is the case. There were vast treasures in Constantinople. Remember that Constantine had moved the capital of the Roman Empire to Constantinople. And so there was all kinds of gold and money, and of course all of the relics. I mean, again, you have Mary's breast milk and Thomas's toe and everything else there. Seriously. Peter's skull and everything. And so, I mean, these guys go in there and tear all that stuff down and are hauling it out. And again, the Pope is sitting there pitching a little fit, stamping his little pink feet, saying, "I'm going to excommunicate you." Meanwhile, this army just kind of peters out because they were just tired of fighting and they wound up not going to Egypt after all. So that was the Fourth Crusade. Are you bored yet? Well, now is the Children's Crusade. 1212. A French boy named Stephen, he was 12 years old, had a vision and wound up gathering together 30,000 kids to march. He's a Frenchman, so march to Marseille. And when they get to Marseille, they are certain that the Mediterranean Sea is going to open up and let them walk across on dry land, like Moses. Well, it didn't happen. By the way, at the same time, there was a German boy named Nicholas who was 10 years old, and he managed to gather an army of 20,000 kids from Germany, and they were marching down to Genoa, Italy, again, expecting the Mediterranean Sea to part so they could walk on over to the Holy Land and recapture the holy sites. A bunch of kids. Well, they got there and, you know, it didn't work out. Besides that, a whole bunch of them died on the way. Again, there's 50,000 kids total with the two groups marching on two towns. And a bunch of them die of plague and famine and starvation and stuff along the way. And when the German wing of the army kind of broke down and said, "We can't go any further," Pope Innocent III declined to release them from their vow to go. And all these kids are dying. And he says, "No, you still have to go." The French wing wound up being placed on seven ships owned by a generous man who offered them free passage to Palestine. Again, their number now is down as far as will fit in seven ships, so they're no longer 30,000. But so a generous merchant man decides that he will set aside seven ships to haul these kids over to Palestine so they can march on, you know, on Jerusalem and recapture it. So two of the seven ships were shipwrecked. The other five ships reached Africa, where the remaining kids were sold into slavery. And that was the end of the Children's Crusade. The Fifth Crusade, kings of Holland and Germany took an Egyptian port city called Damietta and soon lost it back to the Muslims. The Sixth Crusade was led by Frederick II of Germany. They cut a deal with the Sultan by diplomacy, giving Jerusalem back to the Christians, except the Mosque of Omar and a few other Muslim holy sites. Frederick, again Germany, promptly crowns himself the King of Palestine. And so Pope Gregory excommunicated him. These guys just, you know, it's just funny. Anyway, that was about the end of that. Seventh Crusade, this is up in the 1240s now, 1270s, led by Louis IX of France, got badly defeated in Egypt in 1248, and then he went back again and tried again and died doing so. But the bottom line is that the effects of the Crusades were a lot of nothing. The Crusaders, again, all Roman Catholics, and we know, you know, Roman Catholic pagans. Along the way, there's rapine, there's stealing, looting, destruction all along the way. They're leaving behind a trail of what people do when they're in 70 and 80,000 person armies. I mean, you got to go to the bathroom somewhere. And you got to eat something. And you got to drink something, right? Well, where you get, you know, I mean, they're destroying streams. They're leaving behind dead bodies that have died of plague and everything else. And along the way, they're raping, you know, women and men along the way. They're just, they're pagans. And so it's just a desperate time. They're thirsty. They're hungry. They often don't have enough and they're diseased. And so they're just leaving the dead trail behind them as they're trying to do this holy thing. And so these immoral Roman Catholic, quote unquote, crusaders, it's just a gigantic mortal soap opera going on the whole time. They develop a real testimony, a real reputation of all the people along that route. The savagery of the Christians, the quote-unquote Christians, was very well documented among the Muslims and, by the way, was well remembered. So we always think of Muslims as being barbarians, but they were no less barbaric than the quote-unquote Christians. They looted, robbed, stole everything in sight. It is no exaggeration that many hundreds of thousands of lives were squandered by the papacy in these crusades. All those lives, and most of those lives, I should say, were a young manhood. So you have, you know, husbands, fathers, sons, and brothers, many of them in the prime of life, and there are now hundreds of thousands of them just gone for nothing. And so it literally crippled the European population in the main part of Europe for generations to come, because you had all these this mass of men that were 30 and 40 years old or younger die in these stupid crusades that were just barbaric, you know, pagan marches to try to recover, you know, something from other pagans that God had used against a Christianity that was paganized. So it's just a real mess. All of the historians all, you know, think that this crusade thing, that it was a romantic, idealistic attempt to recover the holy sites from an unholy people and all that stuff. And it's just nonsense. It's just nonsense. So that was the Crusades. It was not a very pretty sight. And aside from just some interesting things that happened, I like Richard the Lionhearted, not because he was a good man, but just because, you know, there's weird stories about him. But as far as it being anything Christian, there was nothing Christian about it. The next thing I wanted to talk about is not terrifically interesting. We covered part of it before, monasticism. Back in the 300s and 400s, a bunch of monks, you know, decided to go live in caves and stuff, and there were lice-infested, flea-bitten, you know, hippies running around naked and eating bugs and stuff. And they thought that was serving God, but as time went by, they began to cloister, C-L-O-I-S-T-E-R, cloister together, and started to share the lice and the fleas. And they became known as super saints, basically. And so they started cloistering together in monasteries and convents and stuff. And so around the 1,000-year mark, for a couple of hundred years there, monasticism was really revived. And so just to go through it, just for the interest of it, some of the monks, some of the monastic orders were military orders. Now, you've probably heard of the Knights of St. John. Those were, where did I see that? These are Germanic knights, again, all Catholics, and they go to Jerusalem to help the pilgrims get through on their journeys. They founded a hospital there to, you know, help them with, you know, getting through on their journeys and healing up their wounds and so on and so forth. They were effectively the Red Cross of the 1100s, but they got really rich because people would give them money for what they were doing. So by the time it's all over with, the Pope had to disband them because they were making so much money. They literally owned entire cities. And again, they were corrupt. There were also the Knights Templar. These were the knights that lived next to Solomon's temple, and they were there to help get pilgrims to and from Jerusalem to the holy sites, because it was dangerous and sometimes people would get robbed, and so they would pay them, and these knights would accompany them and fight off any robbers or anything like that. But by the time they wind up extremely wealthy as well, and so the Pope had to eventually disband them. Also, the Teutonic Knights were the same, and again, these were the, I guess these were the Germans. They wound up owning 50 cities, including cities in Poland and Prussia, because of the amount of money they had from just gathering money together from pilgrims that were trying to get to the Holy Land and back. The Benedictine orders, you may have heard of some Cluniacs. Again, some of this is not very interesting, but these guys tried to help, you know, travelers with hospitality and benevolence and stuff. The Cistercians, another Benedictine type of monk, they placed greater emphasis on self-denial. They lived in a rule of silence. They ate no meat. They could not adorn their churches, that sort of thing. So, folks, in the Dark Ages, you were either, the only professional thing you could do was to become a knight or be a monk. Otherwise, you were a peon. And so if you wanted to break out of some sort of, your social class, you kind of had to, were locked into either becoming a monk or a knight. So, a lot of them did. The Augustinian orders, the Augustinians rose around the 11th century. Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk. Also in that order were the Premonstrants. Norbert was their founder. They weren't allowed to eat eggs or milk or cheese, probably because of their cholesterol. The members of the Premonstrants were not allowed to read and were not taught any theology. They just did whatever the Pope said do. Couldn't even read. There were independent orders. The Carthusians, these were hermits, very ascetic. You remember that word ascetic, A-S-C-E-T-I-C. It means deny the flesh and extremity. Again, live on beans and bugs or something like that. But there were those. There were also the Carmelites under the independent orders. They trace, by the way, oh yeah, the Carmelites. This is my favorite. They're able to trace their roots back to Elijah. Elijah's disciples were Jonah, Micah, and Obadiah. And Obadiah's wife was the first abbess for the Carmelites. You don't seem impressed. Yeah, it's because they made it up. But it's, yeah, stupid. They're often called the Brotherhood of the Scapulary. A scapulary is something a priest wears. It's like a, I don't know, it's like a short sweater or something. You know, it's like a, you put a sweater on it, but it's only like this long. It's just over your shoulders and kind of, you know, stops about here. But if you died with that on, you went to heaven. And so they were the Brotherhood of the Scapulary. Then there were the Mendicant Orders. Now that's, mendicant means begging. The Franciscan monks fit in this category. They were founded by St. Francis of Assisi. St. Francis was Assisi. Seriously, so St. Francis, Minnesota was named after St. Francis. These were known as friars. Friars means brothers. Francis was reputed to be a good preacher and all those things, but the friars were sanctioned by Innocent III. It was eventually wrenched away from them, and Francis was the guy who reportedly had tremendous power over nature. He, for instance, he preached to the birds. And, oh yeah, and I shouldn't forget to tell you that there was a wolf in a certain area that was known to be a great menace to women and children. And one time the wolf came and attacked St. Francis. And St. Francis rebuked him and told him to stop. And so the wolf dropped to his stomach and crawled forward on all fours and licked St. Francis's feet and never bothered anybody again. I buy it, don't you? I do. But that's the Franciscans. Now, the other group that you'll be aware of under the mendicants were the Dominicans. Their founder was Dominic Guzman. Dominic was more austere than Francis. By the time it's all over with, the Dominican monks became the quote-unquote hounds, H-O-U-N-D-S, dogs, the hounds of the Lord. They are the ones that did all the Inquisition stuff under Innocent III. And so they were the ones that tortured, you know, confessions out of innocent people who just didn't believe like they believed. So they were known as the hounds of the Lord. Dominic is credited as being the first one to actually use a rosary, for what it's worth. Then lastly, you have the Jesuits. And that kind of comes at a later time, so I won't spend much time with that. Now, we got started late. I'm debating giving you about 10 more minutes here. Let's do that. So, you have a Frankenstein church. You have kings and popes prostituting entire peoples and nations. Monasteries and convents are filled with ignorant, sadistic, stupid, flea-bitten, lice-infested monks who are deceived and busy deceiving. The only careers in the Middle Ages were knighthood and a priesthood or a monkery. And then you have the Crusades going on, so you're wasting, you know, people right and left. And out of all that arose something, and again, I'm not going to spend much time with this, but I find it somewhat interesting. It's called scholasticism. All right, now, don't think scholarship. Scholasticism was a name given to medieval theology. Now, medieval theology is just the Catholic Church. You know, they have made up volumes of things that have nothing to do with the Bible whatsoever, right? And so the theologians were schoolmen. They're known as schoolmen. And these guys are treated with tremendous reverence. The schoolman's name, you would remember names like Thomas Aquinas, okay? A guy named Anselm, a guy named Albertus Magnus, Peter Abelard, all of those guys are schoolmen. And what the schoolmen are busy doing is basically they're not going to the Bible to try to organize proper doctrine or get any light from the Bible. They're simply taking what the Catholic Church has taught, and they're trying to justify it with reason and organize it. So these are not men looking for the truth. These are men who are already deceived. And so I don't care what you hear about Thomas Aquinas and St. Thomas and all that kind of stuff. Thomas Aquinas was a moron. He was an intelligent, genius moron, but he's a man that had no light whatsoever. And that's what these schoolmen are, and that's what scholasticism is. It was supposed to be this enlightening, liberating influence, and all the historians say that it was. And if you want to hear somebody fawn over someone else, just bring up the name Thomas Aquinas or Abelard or some of these guys, William of Ockham. I mean, you will have people basically fall out in the aisles because they just faint from being so impressed by the intellect of these people. Simply put, scholasticism is a systematic organization and rationalization of Roman Catholic theology that was already believed. They took Roman Catholic theology and justified it by logic and reason, rhetoric and philosophy, and just turned it, and basically just beat it to death and put it down in books. It was something called a Summa Theologiae. Let me give you something. I'll read you something here real quick. You can see why I'm not going to spend much time with it, because I know there's part of it that's kind of boring, but the leading peculiarities of scholasticism and what it subjected or was that it subjected the reason to church authority and sought to prove the dogmas of the church independently by dialectics. Okay, dialectics is logic. They're not taking the Bible and comparing what the Catholic Church teaches with the Bible. They're taking what the Catholic Church teaches and saying that's right, and then they're trying to justify it with rhetoric and logic and reason. That's all it is. It's basically a brand of philosophy. And I don't know, how many of you ever read philosophy at all? Many of you haven't. You're probably wiser for it, because it is boring. I mean, it is bad. It's like wading through, whatever. They're wanting to accomplish, I didn't finish reading, I'm sorry. As for the scriptures, the schoolmen accepted their authority and made a show of extensive acquaintance with their pages, but they did not try to get new light from the scriptures. They only tried to justify what the Catholic Church already taught by reasoning. It was not their concern to search in the scriptures for new truth or in any sense to reopen the investigation of the scriptures. Their task, the task they undertook was to confirm what they already had inherited. For this reason, they made no original contributions to exegesis and biblical theology. They did not pretend to have discovered any new dogmas. They were purveyors of the dogma they had inherited from the Catholic fathers. It was the aim of the schoolmen to accomplish two things: to reconcile dogma and reason, and to arrange the doctrines of the church in an orderly system called Summa Theologia. Okay? So they're just reorganizing what the Catholic Church has always taught, and they are not the least bit interested in bringing light. They would never go and say that Jesus Christ didn't mean you should be eating his flesh and drinking his blood. They're trying to reconcile Augustine, remember Augustine, with Aristotle. So they're right back. How did this all start? The church was born into Gnosticism and Platonism, right? It's philosophy. Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit. Okay, they've come all this way. They're now 1,200 years deep in the church age. And what they're trying to do is take Augustine and justify what he taught by what Aristotle taught. To this point, they didn't know much about Aristotle. Aristotle's works had not been translated up until like 1000 AD or something like that. So they just now have Aristotle's. I mean, they had had Socrates before, they had Plato before, but they had not had Aristotle. So Aristotle is the one they were trying to justify with the scholasticism. So, yeah. Again, I'm not going to take you any more deeply than that, but it was a total joke. And if you've ever taken much time to talk to Roman Catholics, you'll find that they have nothing to stand on whatsoever. And these guys, for all of their brilliance, their intelligence, and all that stuff, they wrote thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of pages just justifying Roman Catholic doctrine and didn't ever go to the Bible. So that's, if there's a lesson about scholasticism, that's it. Questions or comments?